This WBEZ podcast is supported by Hacia, whose Executive Fellows Program provides Black and Latinx business owners with real-world tools and strategies needed to master fundamental management concepts related to company stability and growth. Registrants learn through one-on-one executive coaching sessions with subject matter experts in the areas of finance, business development, operations, and legal. More info at haciaworks.org.
Welcome. You are listening to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal. I am Greta Johnson.
And I'm Trisha Bobita. Back from the woods is Peter Sagal.
I was far away in a complicated place. I'd explain it, but you wouldn't understand. I'm Bran!
Oh, no.
That's going to be my attitude from now on. I'm just going to stare you all with no expression and say, it's complicated.
Oh, man.
I said so.
I look forward to talking more about Bran. But first, two things before we begin. Number one, after the season finale of Game of Thrones, the three of us are hosting a wrap party on Wednesday, August 30th in Chicago's Lincoln Square neighborhood. There will be beverages and show-related snacks, which I don't even know what that means, but it's going to be great.
I was just about to say, are there snacks in Westeros?
Are
there people?
Oh, these books are full of food references.
Yeah, Westerosis are
snackers. Tyrion contemplated the Blackwater Reach while he ate a few chips.
Anywhere.
I don't see that.
Anyway, there will also be general merriment, and we would love for all of you to come. You can find out more at wbez.org/events.
I am also taking suggestions for my cosplay,
oh, yeah.
And let's just accept Varys as a given.
Oh, man.
I know. Everybody wants
Daenerys.
Everybody. You want me to be?
Yes.
Peter, obviously.
I have in my Amazon cart right now.
Oh, good.
A Daenerys wig.
Yeah,
for you.
I'm pretty sure we're moving forward on that.
It's a very long story, but I once did drag a long time ago, and nobody needs to see that. I mean, there's like, for some guys doing drag, there's attractive, that's not me. There's amusing.
Yeah, maybe
also
like charming, quaint.
There's horrifying.
Mm.
That's me.
Well, I think we all need to see for ourselves.
Okay.
Item of business number two. We got a memo from the higher-ups. Trisha, I think you're going to handle this one.
Yeah, so as you know, we sprung for some highly produced, exceptionally expensive special audio effects to help us go from location to location this season. But the bosses upstairs have notes, as they tend to have, and they liked where we were going, but wanted us to go in a new direction.
Oh.
So we've scrapped our Mortal Kombat sounds.
Oh, no.
And now we have something that maybe hopefully sounds a little more fresh. So with that in mind, let's begin our recap of Season 7, Episode 3 of Game of Thrones. This episode was called The Queen's Justice.
Dragonstone.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Like, it's, oh, yeah, go to those, give me that old-time Westerosi blues.
Oh, my gosh. If anything ever felt less like Dragonstone.
Oh, my God.
It would be that harmonica.
I met the red woman at the crossroads. I sold my soul.
Oh, man.
I don't think so.
Wet Dorn 2.0. You guys, were you ready for that introductory scene to just be Jon strolling up on the beach? I was like, I'm not ready for this.
Really?
I had to, like,
it's like you weren't emotionally prepared. You've only been waiting
seven years. Well, that's the thing. I didn't think we'd actually get a payoff that quickly. That never happens in Game of Thrones.
You figured it'd take an episode and a half.
Yeah, for sure.
Just,
I thought it was like maybe at the end of episode 3, Jon would be like halfway there rowing the boat, you know?
They don't have anything else to do.
I mean,
by the way, we have to spend a little time discussing last week's episode because I didn't get to.
Oh, do we?
And, yes, and
do we,
nothing is nothing
I think
is
we're
considered
have to put a
final.
Patriarchy jingle until right in there.
Nobody cares,
yeah.
But it never really stops him. Is Peter still fucking talking?
I think that's a really accurate selection.
You guys missed an important but subtle point about last week's episode.
Us.
It was terrible.
Oh.
It was a bad episode, mainly because it was so filled with killing time. And a lot of other things, but
speechifying.
Speechifying and peeling off grayscale at great length and sex at greater length than even I needed. So I think that with all that killing of time in last episode, it was nice that they finally got down to it in this.
I just keep wondering every time somebody's rowing near Dragonstone if they're just going to come across Robert's living bastard.
Gendry.
Who's the only one who knows how to work with Valyrian steel, for the record.
It's
going to come in quite handy eventually.
I think he's going to end up at that motel where that character from Breaking Bad got left.
Oh,
he's just going to pull up. What are you doing here? I don't know. Moving on.
Oh my gosh, the lingering looks between Tyrion Lannister and Jon Snow in that initial scene when they're like, oh, the bastard, oh, the whatever, and then they just like stare at each other and smile.
Yeah, and there was also a moment where almost, where it was like, oh yes, last time I saw you were on the wall, yes, you were peeing off it.
Uh-huh.
I almost wish that one of them had said, well, previously on Game of Thrones, I saw you. This whole episode was filled with winking and nodding to viewers.
Yeah.
But yes, we know you saw that, and we know what you thought about that, and here's our thoughts about that.
And then there was an Aaron Sorkin-style walk and talk all the way up that narrow staircase.
Sure.
Yes,
for
which
sure.
Steve Johnson of the Tribune calls the walkway of great length.
And Davos and Tyrion met, which was adorable and surprising. That was one of those like, oh yeah, I guess you guys didn't know each other, did you?
Yeah, I guess not. Although Tyrion, because he's well-informed, knew that
Davos was the Onion Knight. They both knew
each other. Tyrion is the one responsible for the death of Davos' son, but he played that cool.
Mm-hmm.
Sons.
Davos lost, all of his children, and Davos seemed okay with that.
Also, anybody notice that Missandei glow she had? She seemed very relaxed.
Very relaxed.
You know?
In other words, if they had had cigarettes in Westeros, she might be smoking one.
Yeah, she seemed to feel pretty good.
Yeah, if she was Ron Swanson, she would have been dressed as Tiger Woods.
I also just really wanted the two of them, and really anyone who was on any of these Dragonstone cliffs, to just bust out a lightsaber. It called for it, I felt, in terms of how they had everyone sort of artfully, you know, distanced from each other and arranged. Yeah.
It was very cinematic. This is a place to mention something that I think is generally a problem, but have you noticed how charmingly avuncular Davos has become in almost every moment?
Yeah.
You know, like when he says to Missandei, oh, where are you from? Oh, I don't know the accent. Oh, never been there. Well, I thought of this when I first saw the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie, but what I was struck by, imagine if you went on it. I know this is going to take a while. Imagine it always does. Imagine if you went on a date with somebody, right? And you liked that person because they were charming and they told jokes. And then you said to the friend who set up the date, hey, I like that guy. He was charming. He told a lot of jokes. And then your friend tells the guy that that's what you said.
Oh, yeah.
And so the next time you see him, he's telling jokes. He's hamming it up because he found out that's what you like.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that something like that is taking place. We love Davos because he's avuncular and funny and laid back. And so, boy, is he avuncular and funny and laid back. And all of the characters, it seems, not just Davos, are behaving in a way that reflects what we all have appreciated about them.
Mm-hmm.
Cersei is being really, really evil, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And Jon is being noble and speechifying and northerly.
And Tyrion is quoting his own self now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Riley, and everybody's being wry, and there's byplay. It's as if, yeah, we all like this when you didn't know we liked it.
Right, yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Also, the moment when Tyrion reassures Jon that he didn't sleep with Sansa.
Yes, I didn't ask.
Yeah. I did like the line, like, she's smarter than she lets on.
Yeah, she's letting on. Good.
So what did you guys think of the long-awaited-for, I'll even say, consummation of this, is Jon ever going to meet Dany, that long scene?
I thought Dany was a child in that scene.
Yeah, man.
She had seemed like she was getting smarter, like when she listened to Lady Olenna, when she did other things. But she sort of was petulant on that throne in a way that I found a little obnoxious, especially the moment where instead of sort of, again, and maybe this is just because they actually have them standing really, really far apart from each other in the room, so they all have to kind of shout to talk to each other.
Yeah.
But the fact that she said to Tyrion, I thought you liked this guy, in sort of full voice instead of like whispering to her hand or having a quiet moment with him, the fact that it was all sort of like at full volume across this hall felt a little weird to me that that's how Dany would react to all of this information in real time, whereas Jon, I thought, was actually more Jon than we've maybe ever seen him.
Yeah, I think
a little
it was
braver than we've maybe ever seen him outside of battle also.
Yeah,
it was fun to see Jon outside of the context of the North, because then it was sort of like he was the most Jon just because he wasn't there anymore, I think.
It's like how you're the most Alaskan when you're not in Alaska.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Trisha, I thought your term petulant was really good. I think in general with this season so far, it's as if the showrunners, I mean, obviously they know the plot points that they have to hit.
Yeah.
And they're doing that, but it feels sloppy to me, or it feels lazy every time. And this was one of those examples where it just seemed, it felt lazy to me. It felt a little obvious.
Lazy,
you know?
Isn't the right word, I think, but by the time we're finished talking about that episode, we'll probably come up with it, because the quality
you
that
know?
You're talking about,
yeah,
which
just,
I know what
or
you mean.
Like slapdash or
perfunctory.
Something. Perfunctory.
How's
maybe
that?
That's
yeah.
what it is. Yeah.
There are a lot of plot elements that just happened because they had to happen.
Right, right.
But not in a particularly satisfying or interesting way, and sometimes in ways that made you go, wait, what? And we can talk about that when we get to the utter failure of Tyrion's strategy and the ways in which the forces of good, and that's a problem that we have now, the forces of good versus
right,
the forces
right.
of evil, are defeated and set back. We understand they have to be defeated and set back, just as we understand that it's very important that for the purposes of the plot that Jon and Dany don't go, yes, you're right, let's join forces. Come on, my guys, your dragons, your Dothraki, let's go. If they did that, we have the same problem we've been talking about. The entire TV series would be over next week.
Right.
So they have to put in obstacles. But they're doing it in a perfunctory and way that bespeaks their necessity as opposed to any kind of interesting, intelligent writing character stuff. The
yeah.
stuff that we actually like this
yeah.
TV show for.
Though I did think there were a couple good lines between Dany and Jon, especially when Jon says that thing about how we're all children.
Yes.
Fighting a game, playing a game, complaining that the rules aren't fair.
Right. Yeah, and there was, I mean, I actually thought that this episode was better than last week's episode,
mm-hmm.
if only because last week's episode was killing time and now stuff actually happened, like the meeting. And there was great writing. These guys know how to write. But at the same time, again, she makes that big speech, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the speech, to their credit, John, I think, says what I was thinking was, so are you going to help me with the Army of the Dead or not? I mean, the whole
yeah.
speech was, I mean, it was like, here I am, this is who I am, this is what I've done, this is my perspective on myself, this is how I have learned, this is how I have grown. And yeah, what? What was
right,
that for?
Right.
And then Davos made a nice speech.
Those hard sons of bitches chose
yes.
him.
Oh, yes. That's what Davos's role is he stands next to
I
kings
loved that.
And argues their virtues to skeptical people.
That's why I love him and Tyrion the most, though. They're still my two favorite characters. And actually, I thought the stuff between Jon and Tyrion on the cliff
mm-hmm.
was some of my favorites. We actually have a little bit of that.
How do I convince people who don't know me that an enemy they don't believe in is coming to kill them all?
Good question.
I know it's a good question. I'm looking for an answer.
People's minds aren't made for problems that large. White Walkers, the Night King, Army of the Dead. It's almost a relief to confront a comfortable, familiar monster like my sister.
That was a good line.
It's a fine line, and it's a good line. It, however, doesn't really have Tyrion. It doesn't show Tyrion doing anything except being Ryan observant.
Right.
But
that's,
he also,
that's Tyrion.
No, it isn't.
No,
damn
but
it.
He's also realizing that Jon's here for a reason because
right.
it's not here to bend a knee. And so he's like, tell me what it is. And so he figures out that it's dragonglass and then gets Dany to do the dragonglass mine permit that Jon needs. I guess there were zoning permits at play here in this episode, I guess. But I like that, too, because it's also, as we've all talked about many times on this show and that everyone talks about with Game of Thrones, collective action being the sort of bigger picture idea that, like, humans, if they don't have collective action against something like climate change, aka winter is coming, they're all going to die. That was, to me, the most succinct version of that argument in the show that, yeah, you can't convince people because it's too big to think about something that scary. And that's actually what scientists say about climate change. Because it's looming and because they can't see it, they will keep fighting with each other and fighting smaller battles because climate change is too big and too scary.
How, I mean, I know this climate change metaphor is widespread. How conscious do you think the showmakers are of it? Do you think they're actually pushing this or do you think this is like...
I think they are.
You really think so? You think they're thinking about it? You think they're talking about the hockey stick graph and all that stuff?
I think they're trying to shake us a little bit and go, you know, if we all just keep fighting with each other and ignoring this larger otherworldly threat that we can't fix with politics... against each other. I think it's intentional. I do. I actually think that it's not like the primary purpose of the show, but it is intentional to keep bringing that up.
There's a parallel that I really appreciated with Jon seeing the dragons for the first time that
yeah.
I think kind of plays into that, right? Because it's something that he'd heard about a lot, but it wasn't until he actually was surprised by a dragon flying overhead that he was sort of like, oh, holy shit, these are real.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think it's interesting to think about that in terms of Daenerys and the White Walkers also, right? Because it is just one of those things that is very difficult for us to comprehend unless you're actually confronted with the very grim reality of it, which often is by the time it's too late. You know, that's when it's actually like, oh, I get it.
And by the way, if Dany had somehow arranged for the dragon to fly by while they were on the walkway of indeterminate length, that would have been actually cool. There's
mm-hmm.
no indication that
yeah.
that was intentional.
I like that Miss Ende doesn't flinch when they fly over her head. Yes. She's just like, yeah,
she
what?
She smiles a little.
Yeah, there you are. Mm-hmm. She's still thinking about the night before. Or given the weird timeline, the night 3 weeks
yeah,
before.
Man.
We don't know.
Nobody
I
knows.
Do have, I mean, the moment when Danny figures out that the ships had been attacked by Euron and Jon is there, was, and then our next scene is in King's Landing with Euron celebrating, you know, his little grim parade. Like, it was just such a... Like, how does time work here?
My guess is that they discovered teleportation in Westeros in a web extra. You know, it's non-canonical.
Is the doctor in town?
Before we leave Tyrion for a second, are you guys as disappointed as I am in that Tyrion is being so consistently dumb? I mean...
The Casterly Rock thing is just a real bummer.
It's a real bummer. He screwed that up. He screwed up. I mean, his plans are coming to naught. And that's fine. Insofar as we've talked about, they need to put obstacles in the way of the good guys to keep the show from ending next week. But does it have to be Tyrion being so wrong and being so obviously wrong? For example, does no one try to find out where these fleets are? Oh, look, here's Varys, the greatest spy master of our age. Nobody asks him maybe to find out, hey, here's a dragon. Why don't we fly the dragon around?
Reconnaissance
dragon missions.
Yeah,
fly around.
Smart.
Oh, look, there's a fleet. Nobody bothers to do that. And because they're being so dumb, I've been thinking about this all morning, is why is this unsatisfying in a way that other things, for example, the Red Wedding, was satisfying, not in terms of good thing, people get killed, but in terms of like the sort of horror and just sort of delightful dismay at watching good people come to a bad end, right? You're watching that, you're like, oh my God, they've been betrayed and they walked into this trap and I would have done that maybe. You didn't see that coming. Tyrion's just being dumb and it isn't as satisfying in a weird way. And I wish I could understand why.
I do wonder if partly it can be justified just by the fact that he hates his family so much. Like, I think there is a little bit of personal vengeance in it for him.
Fighting their fathers instead of the battles at hand.
If there is a confrontation, which I hope there is, between Dany and Tyrion coming up saying, you've led me into terrible advice, I hope one of the things she points out to him is you were probably thinking about the pleasure and joy of destroying your father's castle rather than advancing our interests.
I also think he's always been more of a politician than a general.
Well, he did win the Battle of Blackwater Bay.
Yeah, with wildfire, which again is like dragons. It's cheating.
Hey, he won. And even, you know, and as he points out, and it's interesting, is that maybe only because I've been rereading the second book, which is all about that. Well, I got to spend my time doing something when I'm not talking to you about the show. Is this Tyrion that we now have in season 7 the same Tyrion who successfully won the Battle of Blackwater Bay? Against pretty serious odds. I don't know.
I don't know.
Should we head to town?
To town.
To town.
King's Landing.
Oh, my God.
The look on your face, Peter.
Oh, my God. What is this? It's like Game of Thrones, the 90s sitcom. What was that?
It's lovely.
Oh, my God. Hey.
We're trying to incorporate the notes from the bosses.
That is really funny
fresh.
To think of that music and then Euron's fucked up parade.
Yeah, hearing that music underscore is jaunting.
Greyjoy!
It does make a little sense because Euron does dress like a prog rocker, you know?
God.
I mean, you know that when he's not like leading raids on enemies, he's playing the synth.
And getting hard, dragging his sister.
He said that, yes. Dragging his niece through.
Yeah. Miles, Dernboss, who I think of as the usurper, said something really interesting last week on this podcast in my absence. He said that Euron is the first campy villain.
Mm.
And he's totally right.
Yeah.
He's the first sort of flamboyantly evil.
He's having fun.
Having fun, being evil for evil's sake, saying things like that, or what he then said to Jaime Lannister, which was just awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Also, bum feels a little anachronistic, doesn't it?
Bum. Well.
Right? That's the issue I have with that scene. Bum, though.
Just the look on Jamie's face. The what?
Oh, my gosh.
But do we want a campy villain on Game of Thrones? Is this a good thing in terms of why we like this show? I mean, Ramsay Bolton was not campy.
It feels
neither was Joffrey.
Like he's from Pirates of the Caribbean and he's been dropped into the
show.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like it.
And that's a very different style. I mean, you know, the villain in the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, played by Jeffrey Rush, was evil, killed people. He was fun. He was a fun villain.
He was based on a ride at a theme park.
I know, and fun villains have their place, but it's not in this show.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't mind it so much, at least so far. I think it speaks to the fact that he's not from, you know, he's an Iron Islands guy, you know?
He's a pirate.
He's like from Ibiza. Like, that's the island he's from.
He's not the same as them, and he's a ridiculous person, and it's obvious.
He's not from the Iron Islands. He's from a Royal Caribbean sketch show.
Exactly. he's like the after-dinner entertainment at Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville
on
Aruba.
So much eyeliner.
It's really terrifying.
How effectively do you think Cersei's going to be able to put him off? Oh, yeah, I'll marry you. You'll get your prize after the war. Like, that's seems like such an obvious delay.
Either she doesn't ever have to because he doesn't survive the war, or she just doesn't do it then. Like, she doesn't fuck anybody else.
I don't know what's going on with Cersei. We're in town now, right?
Oh, yeah. Do you need to hear the jingle again to be sure?
No. Hey, on tonight's episode of King's Landing, Cersei gets into some mischief.
Well timed, sir.
Where's Cersei now? Cersei has also become just a stone villain.
Man. This episode especially, that was brutal.
Yeah, and that's all she does now, is she just behaves villainously and has sex with her brother.
I don't know. I thought the scene between her and I looked up his name. Hang on. Somewhere in my notes
is the name of
the Braavos banker.
All I know is he's played by Mark Gatiss of Doctor Who fame.
Yes, I call him Mycroft, and so do most of the recappers of the internet. We just call him Mycroft.
Twitter called him Mycroft also. Your notes are in two columns this week, Trisha.
Yeah, it's like an E. Cummings poem over here in my notes. Something happened with the printer.
I'm impressed.
Anyway, Mycroft of the Iron Bank.
Yes.
I think that that's actually a really good Cersei as a political actor scene. We had a clip of that.
Yeah, totally.
Explain. From what I gather, she considers herself more of a revolutionary than a monarch. Mm-hmm. In your experience, how do bankers usually fare with revolutionaries? The Lannisters owe the Iron Bank quite a lot of money, but Lannisters always pay their debts to former slaves, or Dothraki, or dragons.
Your father's daughter, indeed.
Give me a fortnight. Stay in King's Landing as my honored guest, and when you return to Braavos, I swear to you, my debt will be paid in full.
That makes me nervous.
Well, I was thinking about that as well. Have we, in fact, by the end of the episode, seen what she meant?
The gold of Highgarden.
Exactly. The riches of Highgarden, which is another problem. But still, was she indicating that she had that plan in mind when she was talking to Mark Gatiss of the Iron Bank?
I believe so, yeah. Because even in that scene, they made sure to have Jaime walk past someone who was writing down something about how much gold was in, like, a trunk of gold. And then in the next time on, we see a whole, you know,
bucket of gold.
A wheelhouse full of gold. Heading, I think, back to King's
Landing. Oh, well, then there you are.
So, yeah, I think that was not just about, giving up on Casterly Rock for military advantage to sort of strand the Unsullied on the other side of the continent.
Right.
But I think they were like, you know what we need? We need money. Where's the money? Highgarden.
Right.
It's also agriculture, so the showrunners said, inside the artist's, the actor's studio, which I actually watched yesterday.
Inside the actor's studio?
With
that guy with that weird beard talking to...
James Lipton was there?
James Lipton talking to Jamie Lannister going, tell me about, if your sister were a tree.
Yeah, it was great, guys.
Is your favorite word?
You guys didn't see that?
Scrumtralescent.
It was scrumtralescent. That makes me think of Dumbledore.
Cersei is now clearly the principal villain of this show, with Euron as villain number two. Is she satisfying to you as a TV viewer? Cersei has always been a really interesting and complex character, partially because she has always been about defending her children.
Yeah.
Her children are now dead. So we're going to expect something different from her. But has this made her, again, into a more standard kind of, I almost said black hat. I should have said black dress, in that she's somebody we can just jeer and boo, but doesn't represent the kind of complex villainy that's both scary and fascinating that we've seen in this show.
I think she definitely is showing the sort of hubris that means that she's not long for this world in this show. So I am tolerant of it because I feel like it's coming to an end very soon. Because otherwise it has become a little one note.
Yeah.
The, you know, the costuming, by the way, has gotten more and more
arch. Yeah. Wow.
Literally,
oh, yeah.
The shoulders the have pokey spikes that just keep getting bigger.
Amazing.
She is turning into the Wicked Witch.
Exactly. Yeah. She's like a Wicked Witch Disney villain sort
of
thing
I said Wicked Witch, but I meant Evil Stepmother.
Yep.
From like, the classic Snow White. That's what she's starting to look like.
Also, fun fact, because if you go on the IMDb page for the episode, you can find out that the actress who played the handmaiden who came to the door to see her and Dany has actually been with Cersei and Sansa since the very beginning. She's
no
one of
kidding.
Her most trusted ones
oh, wow.
who was like a spy for Sansa.
Yeah.
Same outfit.
Which makes me wonder if that actress isn't maybe going to pop up again eventually as a face that Arya steals. Just calling it,
whoa.
Just going to put that tiny prediction in
Damn.
A hat.
Possible.
Yeah.
I also wonder...
Bernadette, her name is.
Bernadette.
Bernadette.
Also, did anybody else wonder when Cersei got up and got out of bed to go answer the door, whether that was another body double?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I don't know why I've decided it was, but there was something about it that made me think like, yeah, also Lena has said that she doesn't do that.
I thought maybe it was just dimly lit enough that she'd be okay
I was with thinking it. To myself, well, if Lena Headey had said, no, I'm not going to do the nude scene and the big walking down the street scene from a couple seasons ago, it's unlikely that she'd say, yeah, I'll get out of bed buck naked, no problem.
Right. Yeah.
I would say I do not find her storyline interesting necessarily, or her as a character interesting, but I do find her to be much more formidable as an enemy after this episode than I did. Like, I was not taking her seriously at all, and then to see her behavior this episode is like, okay, she's still gonna fuck up a lot of shit before she leaves.
They have solved, and since I've been ragging on them, I'll give them this: they've solved a problem from the books, in which Cersei became pretty stupid, reckless, and dumb. In fact, so reckless and dumb that one of the plots in the books is that Varys wants her to be in charge when he's still in King's Landing, being spider-like, because he knows that her recklessness and stupidity, such as when she elevated the High Sparrow, would actually help him in his goal of destabilizing the regime. And so she's not stupid anymore, which is nice. I think that makes her a little more serious in terms of like what's to come. So
also
golf clap.
Also, I think that this war basically so far has been Tywin Lannister playing chess against himself, right? So everything that each of his children have learned is now being pitted against these two siblings who are, well, three. I think Jaime, as the general, is probably the one who said to Cersei, like, here's what we should do and I'm going to do this or whatever. But I think it's interesting to see that there's this one sort of very present character still who's been killed off now for quite a while, who everyone is referencing constantly, and that is the father of the Lannister children.
Right.
At least most of them.
And as we all know, if this show is about anything, it's about parents and children and the effect of the former on the latter.
Yeah, I feel like there were a lot of nods to that in this episode.
Oh, yeah. They know that. We know that. Everybody knows that.
All right. More in just a minute. All right. We're back, and we've been already talking about the fact that we had King's Landing relating to another place, the home of the Lannisters.
Yeah, let's get back to this Tywin nonsense.
We've never seen it before.
No.
It's very exciting
for
me.
The Rock. Did he actually call it The Rock at one point, or am I making that up? I feel like... Oh, right.
Casterly Rock.
Oh, boy.
That was like a Seinfeld transition. Right? And now we're back at Casterly Rock, where Kramer has a scheme.
Well, that's pretty
cute. Am just going to say...
How did you feel, Peter, about the sort of Peter Dinklage as audiobook narrator over
that
this
seemed
footage?
So tacky.
Well, it
was... Well, Greta, now we know.
That's all I have to say about it.
Since I was complaining about the killing of time in last week's episode, I guess I can't fault them for doing something that saved time.
That's true.
Just by having Peter Dinklage explain what was going on while we saw it saved a lot of time of, you know, seeing Grey Worm saying, well, Tyrion Lannister told us about this, so let's go here.
Yeah, that's
you know,
true.
So that I was efficient. All I could think of is they're running out of Unsullied.
Yeah.
Every time we see the Unsullied have a fight, they kill more of them. There's a limited number of Unsullied.
It doesn't feel right.
They do not reproduce.
They don't.
It's problematic.
I think, I know.
On a couple different levels.
Yeah.
I thought it was efficient. At first, I thought it was weird that they were doing it in voiceover, but then I realized there's really, except for Grey Worm, no named character in that battle for us to have the point of view and watch it through, which
True.
Is how the show usually handles battles, which is why I like battle scenes in Game of Thrones more than other types of things in this genre, is that they give you a character to hold on to through the battle scenes, but they really would have had to do just Grey Worm, and even that wouldn't have been probably enough.
I just want to point out that way back in season one, they didn't really have the budget for battle scenes. So you may remember they handled the big battle at the end of that season between the Lannisters and the Starks by having Tyrion get knocked out at the very beginning. And then he wakes up and he says, what happened? He says, you missed the whole thing. We won. Oh, yeah, we missed the whole. And we saved millions of dollars on extras, says Braun, I think. Moving on. So it was nice. You have a battle scene and they go in and they kill a bunch of guys. And then they stand there and go, wait a minute. And then you cut to Highgarden.
I really loved how they handled Jaime walking with such intention.
Yes.
To find Olenna.
Right.
And you know, we just got a battle scene at Casterly Rocks. So
hang
we didn't
on, I'm
going
to get I'm going to get in trouble if we head to Highgarden before.
Oh, okay.
All right.
What do you got?
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
oh, right.
It's
I'm sorry.
Reunited. It's King Crimson.
The other side of the continent. Highgarden.
I wasn't that far off. Yeah.
I find them very endearing, I have to say.
You're a nice person,
Greta. We're going to have to give notes on these notes. I think we may be overcorrected.
Oh, dear.
I don't know.
Is it really in our control, though, Trisha?
You know, when the network gives notes.
Do we have anything to do with these at all?
In the After the Episode special with Benioff and Weiss explaining to us what we've just seen, they did mention that they chose, instead of showing another battle, to just show the aftermath of Jaime Lannister walking from the wall, outer walls into the center of the keep, showing their victory is complete, passing all the post-battle scenes, the pulling aside of bodies, and as
the
you
counting
said,
of gold.
The counting of gold and, you know, of treasure and loot until he arrives at Olenna's little chamber.
I liked it.
Yeah, it was. I think at that point we didn't need to see, as you say, Tricia, since there was nobody there who we knew, we didn't need to see more anonymous extras beating each other up over the head.
But we did have a pretty brilliant goodbye to one of my favorite characters.
Oh my gosh. I feel like, what should we do? Should we pour out a little or just like
pour out some wine?
Raise a glass?
Pour out some wine. I got coffee. You guys got water. Tricia has a what is that? What are you drinking?
It's actually just water. It was water that had a tiny bit of flavor in it because that is as zesty as my life gets.
That was the saddest thing we've ever said. Oh. And we've talked about 400 deaths in the last 2 years.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, here's to Olenna.
To Olenna.
We loved you. It was great to see you back.
Skull.
And yet she managed the entire TV series. This is 4 seasons of brilliant character acting without ever taking off her hat.
Oh, my God. If everybody goes out like that, man, I
you know
am
what
all
I loved
show.
Out of all the it was a great scene, and kudos to the writers and actors. It was probably the best thing in the episode. You know what I love most is how she just guzzled that wine.
Yeah
she you did know, just throw it back.
Other actors might have, that little hesitant of Socrates raising the cup. But she was like, oh, no, this is great. This is obviously the best outcome. Let's do this. Oh. I totally accept what has happened. Except, wait a minute. Highgarden is undefended. Highgarden, the seat of the wealth of Westeros. Highgarden, the army that Tyrion is going to count on, along with the now gone Dorne, to lay siege to King's Landing, and they got nobody? They're just a bunch of guys?
Like
they're a bunch of farmers?
Switzerland.
Well,
know.
That's why it was important in the previous episode, I think, for them to establish that the forces that would have been there, the Tarleys, were in fact riding with the Lannisters.
Yes. I do think that was a very important shot of mean old dad Tarly.
Randall and Dickon.
Exactly.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
Dickon sitting right there along with Jaime, showing that Jaime succeeded. Was that ambiguous at the end of last episode, whether old mean man Tarly was going to go over to the Jaime side? Well, it was clear that he did, and obviously that changed everything for the poor Tyrells.
Yeah.
The moment.
I mean, really just the one Tyrell who we cared about.
She's the only one left.
She's the only one
left.
You
know what's interesting is that there is only one. But no, I take it back. There were, at last count, prior to this episode, 3 characters I can think of who had and will have no children and therefore don't have a legacy to fight for. Those would be Olenna Tyrell, now gone, Cersei, of course, and Dany. She says, I am the last of the Targaryens. And when she said that, I don't know if she meant I'm the one who's here or if she meant I can't have children, which was established in the books more clearly than in the TV show, that whatever that witch did to her at the end of season one to kill her child also prevented her from ever having children. So she is the last of a line. So whatever she's fighting for is, you know, as to paraphrase Cersei, it's a dynasty for ourselves. They don't have any legacy to fight for, which in a show about parents and children is an interesting twist.
I think my favorite moment was when Olenna called Joffrey a cunt.
Oh, that was great. Best moment of the best scene right there. Yes. Yes, Olenna. People nod all over the world.
BT Dubs killed him. He gone.
Oh, by the way.
That was me.
Yes.
Tell Cerse.
Point me. Do you wish that we had seen her topple over, or was it better just leave the room?
No, she was regal.
Did you think that, for a moment anyway, that Jamie, in a moment of anger perhaps at learning that she in fact had killed his son, whipped out a sword and deprived her of her peaceful end?
I think it was showing us that Jamie is in fact one of the few good guys on the show.
Yeah.
Because to hit an old woman with his golden hand or to, you know, stab her with a sword or something after he'd promised her no pain.
Yeah.
It means he understands that Joffrey was a monster, and mm-hmm. it maybe means that he understands that Cersei is a monster. Like, he is, in this weird way, like, just so enamored with her
yeah.
and so tied up with his sister that he can't really see it. But there was a lot of subtle face acting attempting happening there. Because they were like, is he the Kingslayer, now the Queenslayer, or is Cersei going to kill him? Like, that's one of the big questions that remains for me, who's going to kill who of the
twins? I just flashed again on Jamie and inside the actor's studio, like, James Lipton going, so tell me about face acting. Well...
In this episode, he had to respond to Euron with no words and basically responded to Olenna with no words
basically,
during that whole bit.
Jamie has been reduced in many ways to just looking around sort of in shock and dismay and extreme discomfort at just about everything.
That does sum it up pretty
well. Which is a weird place for the Kingslayer to end up.
I did find it helpful to hear him talk about how he envisions Cersei ruling turning out when he's talking to Olenna, and he says that thing about, like, well, once it's all good, nobody will hold her responsible for the things she did in the past. It's such a fascinating rationale, but it was interesting to hear him say that just in terms of the idea that, like, he seems to be talking himself into the fact that this is actually a good idea.
Yeah, well, and that seems to be how it works in this world.
I know. I just thought it was useful to actually see him express that, because otherwise it was sort of like, really, dude? And I'm still skeptical of the actual notion, but I found it.
Well, remember, Daenerys crucified a few hundred people, and we like her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair point.
Cersei is just becoming more and more like the Mad King, though, right? Because what she does to Ilaria Sand and to, I think it's Tyeen Sand, the daughter.
Baby Snake,
Baby Snake in your notes, is she basically kills them in a way not only similar to how Myrcella was killed, her own daughter, but very similar to what we know to be the way that the Mad King killed the Stark grandfather and uncle.
Mm. I.e. chained them up so that one could not reach the other.
Yeah.
Although that had some evil twist in what the more the son, I believe, tried to save the father, the more son strangled himself through this arrangement of chains.
If he could have reached the sword, he would have been able to save
them. That is so awful. Yeah.
The parallels between Cersei and the Mad King are fairly obvious. We remember that she killed her enemies by using the Mad King's pyrotechnics.
Yep.
So she is very much his heir.
Should we head to Winterfell? Is it time?
Let's do it.
Things are happening in Winterfell.
All right, now I'm done.
Now we're done.
Now I'm done.
Meanwhile, in Winterfell, it's a blaxploitation movie.
No,
that's their next show.
Oh, God.
Uh-oh.
Oh, hey. Hey-o.
So, Littlefinger.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk
Littlefinger, I've been very annoyed, as you have been, with Littlefinger for a long time, with his smirking and standing and lusting.
And raspiness.
I liked Sansa being like, you don't have to tell me why Cersei is dangerous. Please don't mansplain to me, sir, the danger that is Cersei Lannister. I am well aware.
I did really like Littlefinger's little speech about how you imagine everything happening, and then you're never surprised, which I thought was like, yeah.
I liked it, but I also found it pretty ridiculous. Like, don't fight in the north or the south. Fight everywhere all the time in your mind.
Yeah.
It's just like, really, dude?
Yeah, it's the kind of advice that sounds really good, I guess, when you have Aidan Gillen say it. But actually, what do I do?
Yeah, there's no actual helpful advice.
Yeah,
You know, like, yes, of course, you want to foresee all possible outcomes so that you're not surprised. But also, like, fight every battle everywhere all the time in your mind. It's just like, really?
It's like
really?
It's the opposite of my Headspace app.
Exactly.
It is your Headspace app?
It's like a meditation app. It's like the opposite of useful mindfulness.
So the purposes of the scenes up in Winterfell
constant
were to show...
Constant vigilance. That's what it is.
Constant vigilance.
Constant vigilance, indeed.
Sorry, what were you saying?
I was saying, is there a jingle for ignoring me? Is there...
No.
No, it's just a thing. is the purpose of...
I did apologize.
All right. The purpose of... falls in the forest. Does anybody give a shit? I'm telling you guys, these will fade in power from overuse. I'm just saying.
The audience will decide.
Yeah, okay. We'll let the audience make that decision.
The purposes of the scene up in Winterfell were to show, as John says in another scene, yes, she's letting on how smart she is. There were specific scenes to show that Sansa is really smart. Oh, let's bring all the grain in because they're going to be coming here for food.
Yeah.
Oh, you should put leather. Is that what her idea?
Yeah, leather on the armor.
Yeah. She's taking charge.
She's taking charge. And it was almost as if they were coming. Well, let's show ways in which Sansa is being smart. Putting leather on armor?
Perfunctory.
Yes. Perfunctory. Again.
Hashtag perfunctory.
So we have an awkward reunion with Bran. I'm really glad they finally hugged. I think that was the only hug this episode. I think I'm going to start counting hugs just because I really wanted Jorah and Sam to hug and they didn't.
But they, well.
Anyway.
Oh, you're going to hug Jorah?
I mean,
no. Really?
He's fine. He's
no
good.
Touching.
Anyway, okay. No touching. Thank you, Trisha. The one thing I would like to say about Bran, if you would entertain me, is that his face is so perfect for this role. He has just aged into, like, such a fascinating, weird-looking dude.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, exquisite for the Three-Eyed Raven, I think.
He does look pretty grim and expressionless.
Yeah, he's just, like, perfectly embodied that role.
Yeah, they lucked out with that actor's bone structure, I guess.
Well, because he's changed so much,
yeah, he was,
too.
Really
he was
little
a
kid.
Little kid, so it's kind of, it's awesome to see that, I think.
But that scene where it's like, I'm the Three-Eyed Raven, what's that?
Yeah.
Says, well... And then she's like, I thought you said you were the Three-Eyed Raven.
It's
like,
complicated.
It's complicated.
It's like the Dread Pirate Roberts. Why doesn't he just explain that it's like the Dread Pirate Roberts? There's only one at
should.
A time.
He said, you ever read The Princess Bride? There were a lot of jokes already about Bran's attitude, about like, well, it's complicated. You wouldn't understand. But the best one came from a comedy writer named Bess Cobb on Twitter, which was like, he's acting like a 20-year-old back from Burning Man. You wouldn't understand. I had this experience.
I saw so many things. I can't even make sense of them.
I was
yet.
Like, amazing. I'm sort of in an advanced place right now, and I really don't think that you guys would understand. You really have to go there. I mean, you really have to be there on the playa, you know, and just have the experience. It's really impossible to understand to people like you. Anyway, what is he going to do? He didn't actually say anything to her except freaking her out. Like, oh, how shall I express to my dear long-lost sister how I see things and know things? How will I demonstrate this power?
I'll remind her of her rape.
Exactly. And that, I mean, it was almost calculated to offend her and drive her out of the scene.
I think not just offend her, but like freak her out.
Yeah.
Like that's scary.
Yeah, as opposed
and
to.
And disturbing.
Exactly. Or maybe it would have been better to say, hey, let me tell you this interesting thing about the guy we think is our half-brother.
Right.
You're not going to believe this. He couldn't mention that. No, he had to mention the very worst night of her terrible life.
Well, but as a person who we've now seen do this twice, it seems like his go-to trick to get people to quickly believe him is describe something that person feels like there's no possible way someone else could know
right.
that happened to them, like in a level of detail, right? It's like, it reminds me of The Mentalist, that terrible CBS show that I watched because the guy was real pretty.
Where he was so lovely.
I'm going to say, yes, he was. He was a handsome fellow, that
Patrick
guy.
Patrick Jane. Is he? What's he? Anyway.
Can he
is
be
he anywhere
on
near?
What's Patrick Jane up to?
But,
moving
you know,
on.
This is the idea, right? As he goes, like, he says to what's his face, Ed, Dolores Ed, as I called him.
Dolores.
He says, you know, something about something only he had witnessed. And then he does that to Sansa, too. He's like, it was snowing on the night of your wedding. How would somebody else have known that, told him that? You know, it's. I also think it just shows that he kind of doesn't have emotion left anymore because
right.
he has too much other stuff in his
that's
head.
That's true. And that's the flip side of what I just said. The fact that he did something that was both cruel and counterproductive kind of indicates that he's become, I almost hate to use this, but a little spectrum-y. He doesn't really have any more understanding of how other people's emotions work now.
He's a savant of some sort.
Well, don't you think also, like, if your scope of knowledge is as huge as his is, Sansa's feelings don't matter anymore.
Right.
You know,
he's almost become like the Watcher in Marvel Comics.
Oh, good.
I watch. I observe. But what is his goal? He has come back from the north. He had to, of course, because their sanctuary where the Three-Eyed Raven used to be has been overrun by dead people. But what does he want now? What is he? What is his interest in trying to help John in some way, gather the forces to oppose the Night King?
I think he needs to be near the tree because he's still not very good at seeing things without the tree.
True.
Right.
So he needs to hang out by the tree and figure out what he maybe is supposed to do. And I am all for Bran's going back in time to become Bran the Builder and get stuck back in time. That's what I think is going to happen next.
You're going with that internet theory.
Oh, yeah. Into it.
Okay.
It seems to me both Bran and Melisandre actually have roles they know they have to play, but we don't know what those are necessarily
right.
yet.
So have we covered everybody except for our old friend Samuel Tarly?
I think so, yeah.
Sam Tarly, MD.
I hate to say... Oh, God.
Back again at the Citadel.
They enjoy smooth jazz at the Citadel? Is that what you're saying? And now here's Maester Kenny G.
Oh, no. All right.
He's the chain for circular breathing. Oh, God.
Oh, dear.
So now we have discovered that the whole point of the journey of Jorah and Samwell was to get Jorah back on the game board, to use a phrase I used last year when we were talking about somebody we haven't seen for a little while, which is... couple episodes now, which is Sandor Clegane, the Hound.
Oh, yeah.
So I said the same thing about him last season. Well, they needed to get him back in the game board. Well, now he's cured.
Yeah,
yay.
Which was useful,
whatever.
I guess, but who cares?
Well, they clearly have some purpose in mind for him. What do you guys think it's going to be? Is he going to run up, ride up, I should say, and save Daenerys or her fortune or purpose at the last minute?
I don't know. I was kind of hoping he would bring Sam to Dragonstone and then they could all hang out in Dragonstone because John would still be there, too.
He hasn't read the rotting scrolls yet.
I know.
They're going to have very important information in them.
I know. It's not going to happen. That was just my, like, oh, that would be kind of fun if
just
they
see
all
him hanging
hung out together.
It'd be like after hours at Dragonstone.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You know, they're just hanging around the table drinking wine and chatting.
Mm-hmm. Listening
that wouldn't
to
be so bad,
jingles.
Actually. That would be all right,
I
think.
Wouldn't it be nice?
I know. But Samwell Tarly, as you saw, he did a terrible thing. And I saw in your notes, Tricia, that you mentioned there's a similarity here to Harry Potter, not just because of Jim Broadbent playing the Maester.
Yes.
But you're right in that, so Sam Tarly, much like Harry Potter, broke the rules.
Mm-hmm.
He was specifically told, do not do this. You cannot do this. This is forbidden. Do not do this. You break against the rules. No, no, no. And he goes ahead and does it because he's the hero. And like all heroes, he gets away with it.
Yes. Because, in part, he doesn't have a Hermione. If he did...
Now... If you two don't mind, I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed. Or worse, expelled.
I miss her.
Thank you, Tricia, for
getting that. I miss her.
Yeah.
Really. There's nothing that in my life that wouldn't be solved by just seeing her punch Draco Malfoy every now and then.
Oh, you're not listening to Harry Potter on a constant loop?
I'm not, unlike some people I know
oh,
I'm sitting in a studio with.
Weird.
I know. Anyway, moving on. So yes, it's almost annoying. In that there are so many things about this particular episode, the last two really, on this TV show that bother me because they're like TV shows. You know what I mean? Campy villains who
yeah.
show up anywhere. Samwell Tarly breaking the rules, succeeding and getting forgiven because he's the hero and that's what happens to heroes. They're not punished for doing the right thing. And I know it's a TV show, but the whole reason
I love
this TV show is because it's not like a TV show.
Yeah, well, it wasn't because it was based on books.
I know.
No, it's not.
And don't get me started on that.
Yeah, I think you've just got some angst.
I do.
Have a feeling it will continue to develop.
So what happens to Samwell now? So he and Jim Broadbent are tight. He's going to...
He's got detention, but it's better
than
his previous
jobs. He has to write, I shall not tell
lies.
It is true. He doesn't have to clean up. Well, I'm not even going to say it.
Soup.
Yeah, but do you think that you've had this notion, Tricia, for a while that it's Samwell who's going to save the day? I guess in addition to Bran saving the day. So, do you still think we're on track for that? Now that Samwell has contributed two important plot points, he found out about the Dragonglass under Dragonstone, which is proceeding. They're getting the Dragonglass, and he cured Jorah Mormont, so that Jorah Mormont can go off into the game board again and do whatever he's going to do. Does Samwell Tarly, in your view, have any more role to play in this great saga?
I think there's more to learn, and that is clearly where learning can happen, because the last time there was a winter like this, it would be written about and it would be there. I also think that Archmaester Broadbent, Merwin Ebros, I think is his name,
wow.
I think that he now... sort of trusts and feels like he knows Samwell Tarly as a man.
Yes.
And so I think that table full of scrolls and books are not actually there because they're rotting. They're there because they because the Archmaester, who says on paper that maesters aren't to get involved, that they're not to be political, he has set out a set of readings basically for Sam to learn what he needs to learn to help defend against the White Walkers, because he now trusts Sam to do that and is sort of giving him permission to sneakily do the thing that technically maesters aren't supposed to sort of stoop to do,
right,
which is get involved in these other matters. So I think that table of materials was very intentional and is going to be very useful.
Do you think that Sam is heading – he must be heading towards some kind of reunion, confrontation, perhaps even reconciliation with his own evil father?
Well, Randall is now the – you know, sort
the general of the
general
armies
of,
and the warden of the something, the warden of the east, the warden of the
south,
the warden of the south. Okay, warden of the south. So yeah, so there he's clearly back in the game board. And what do you think? Just for the sake of predictions, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that like a lot of children in this show, he's going to kill his parent?
I think he may never actually come up against Randall Tarley again. I think he's going to learn how to make Valyrian steel in one of those books.
Yeah,
and then he's going to go to Dragonstone. And it's just – I mean, it's going to be more tactical than that. Like, they literally need to make the weapons to fight this war, and they don't know how. Only Gendry and Sam are going to know how.
I'm just going to say the worst possible outcome for Samwell and his father is the father looking at him and saying, I was wrong about you, and clapping him on the back.
Oh, yes. If that happens,
I
quit.
I know.
But, yeah, I don't think Sam would kill his father. I think Sam will just outsmart his father.
Right.
Sam Tarly nerd victory style.
Exactly.
All right. Let's hear from some of you, dear listeners, in just a minute.
All right, time now for your voicemails. Let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Vanessa from Irvine, California. I just wanted to make a shout to the scene where Sir Davos is talking about John and is about to reveal that he was killed. And John just turns to him, gives him a look that pretty much says, hey, we don't talk about that. Love the show and to hear what you guys say. Bye.
Was there a reference to that later in the episode? Did someone say who said what?
Danny. Go ahead.
Danny asks Tyrion, like, what was with that thing? How Davos said that Jon was stabbed in the heart, and Tyrion says something like, oh, they're northerners. They make up they have all sorts of flights of fancy.
Yes, another phrase. Does that mean that that fact about Jon is going to play an important role in the way the other characters deal with him when they find out that he is, in fact, resurrected?
Like she is.
Yes. Wait a minute. Is Dany resurrected?
Well, she's unburnt.
She is unburnt. Yes, which is different than being resurrected, I think. But I see your point, that there's something interesting about him in the same way that there's something really interesting about her.
Yeah, I think that that'll be a fun thing to watch play out. It also is funny to me that they're like, listen, zombies, totally real.
Right.
Don't tell them I'm a zombie.
Yeah.
Like,
he's not a zombie.
But he's not a zombie.
It's a paradox. He's both a zombie and not a zombie. He's not a zombie because zombies are mindless. Zombies are under the control of whatever virus and or supernatural force is controlling them. You know this. I know this.
Yes, but that also means that the White Walkers are going to have agency, and I might end up rooting for them.
Oh, right. The White Walkers and their goals.
Oh, yes, because Trisha has a soft spot for the White Walkers. Can we see things from their perspective?
Listen, guys, if we're going to get through this, we have to understand their point of view.
Yeah, come on, guys.
All right, let's listen to another voicemail.
Briefly, at sea.
Oh, oh yeah, we heard that one.
Wait, we forgot. Yeah, we forgot that Theon is alive and no one cares.
No one cares. Oh, let's step over him. Theon has... Theon clearly, and I thought this last week, is heading for some sort of redemption. He has to.
I mean, he has to, because otherwise he's the lamest.
He is. I even thought to myself, you know, when Theon started, like, twitching last episode, like he was Reek again and then jumped off, and everybody said, oh, big coward. I thought he was being smart. What's he going to do? He even said to the captain whoever rescued him, so what's he going to do? Is he going to get killed trying to fight Euron?
Okay, let's actually hear the voicemail now.
Hey guys, this is Bryn calling from Montreal. I just had a question about what you think Melisandre meant when she said she has to die in this country, meaning Westeros. Thanks so much. Love the show. Bye-bye.
Go ahead, Trisha.
I was going to say, we also have another clip, actually, that I queued up because I was hoping we would talk about this weird moment
good,
between Varys and Melisandre.
Looking at the exact quote.
With a hooked blade, he sliced me, root and stem, chanting all the while. He burned my parts in a brazier. The flames turned blue, and I heard a voice answer his call. I still dream of that night. Not of the sorcerer, not of his blade. I dream of the voice from the flames Was it a god? A demon? A conjurer's trick? I don't know.
So that's Varys explaining why he hates magic, including this Red Priestess.
Right.
And also the fact, though, that he has heard a voice from the flames, which means that the Lord of Light has maybe been a part of his nightmares his entire life.
Yeah, we've talked about this. Like, the Lord of Light has a place, has a role in this that the other various gods don't seem to.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's part of it. But I guess the question is, what does Melisandre's hinting at a future prediction or prophecy mean?
That she and Varys both must die in Westeros.
Well, Varys is probably going to die in Westeros. That's where he lives, and everybody dies. But that's what I thought. It's like, I can predict that I will die in America.
You never know, man.
You never know. It's true.
You never know.
Exile could come before then. but what? Clearly, she knows that she has some role to play that she's hinting at.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a good one? Is she going to? I mean, there are hints that a lot of these characters can redeem themselves. Jorah can redeem himself by rescuing Dany. Theon, we just talked about, can redeem himself. Are we being set up for a redemption moment for Melisandre, the evil Red Queen, who burned poor what's her name, Shireen, at the stake? Is there going to be a moment in which she does something, God help us, noble?
Perhaps. She also seems very remorseful in this scene about what she did to Shireen.
I did something bad.
And
Terrible mistakes.
The form of magic she seems to have that she can kind of control, whereas, you know, as we keep getting told by, you know, the Brotherhood Without Banners guy and by Melisandre, they don't decide when the Lord of Light comes to them. He just does or he doesn't. But she can make herself look young magically all the time.
Yes.
Let's not forget that the one time we see her take that necklace off.
Yes.
We then see her as, like, a very, very, very old woman. So if the innate magic she has something to do with this ability to rejuvenate or some sort of youth, then maybe she does have to come back one more time and save John from dying one more time, save someone else.
Right. She
keeps
saying,
youth.
She keeps saying that the Lord of Light keeps her around for some reason. And she seems to have more of an inclination of what that reason is than she's letting on so far.
Yeah, I feel like odds are she will do something cool. And I also do just love the idea that there is a bigger storyline at play, right? Any reference to that, I'm sort of like, oh, thank God, okay, this isn't all just, like, ridiculousness.
Yes.
You know?
I'm glad somebody's in charge, even if
somebody knows what's going to happen.
Even if it's the Red God.
Yeah. All right, Justin, do you have any questions, sir?
Justin, our producer?
I'll just say the only question I had is this the first time there's been, like, a senior loan negotiation on the show in the series, or is this, like,
oh, you missed the invention of the insurance industry back in season 3. That was great. Oh, yeah, there's a long, there's a serious subtext about, like, the creation of the financial sector.
I have some links to Economist articles that I'll send to you,
oh,
Justin.
Oh, yeah, you would like those very much.
Matt Iglesias, who mainly writes these days about the destruction of the American government, used to write some really great pieces about the economics of Westeros, which I highly recommend if you can dig them up. I think he wrote them for Slate way back in the day. But yeah, I mean, there are these bizarre hints that, like, there's this actual economic system. And I wonder about the Iron Bank. What else do they do besides funding various claimants for the throne?
Slavery.
Oh, yeah.
They're in the slave trade.
They're in the slave trade. They do that, yeah. I don't know.
That's about it, though. Cabbage, too. A lot of cabbage.
Do they, like, do, like, startups? Is that, like, a thing they do?
Is there a venture capital
league? Like, for example, whoever invented those flaming things that they're constantly shooting at each other, did they get a nice loan? And why doesn't everybody use the flaming things that they're shooting at each other all the time?
Yeah, Euron's very good at shooting the fire from the ship to the other ship.
I know. And why doesn't everybody shooting flaming things? Because that seemed like a really good way of killing a lot of people in Westeros, much better than running up to them and hitting them with a piece of metal. And yet no one seems to do it unless, like, we're on a ship. It's like, oh, no, you can only use those on ships.
Also, I will say, to Miles' point last week, just another example this week of the fact that the citizens of King's Landing are not
lovely
people.
That's true. Not worth saving. That's a good point.
When they were cheering Euron for reasons that escape everybody.
Yeah.
My favorite tweet from yesterday was someone asking us, is Peter back or where are we going to have the smart guy again? And with that, friends,
No, there's really one more thing, because I lied. I did not go away to the woods last week.
Oh.
I didn't. I went to Old Town. And I brought back something for Trisha from Old Town.
Yay. What? Oh, I totally forgot about this.
Hand it over. So I'm giving a little present from Old Town.
Oh, it doesn't really make much of a jingle.
What?
What is it?
What?
I kept this secret, Trisha.
Oh, my God. You guys.
It's a Meister chain.
It's a Meister chain.
Trisha has now been granted her maester's chain.
Oh my God.
I checked with
Peter,
with Archmaester Broadbent.
This is amazing.
And he said that you have earned
That's
your
beautiful.
Maester's chain. There's a link there for all of your skills, including note-taking. There's one for West Wing quoting.
And also, I think this is probably going to be part of my cosplay at the event,
good.
People should come hang out with us.
I should say that it is not, sadly, to scale. And I honestly, I wished that you could buy, because the Maester's chains in the show are enormous.
Huge.
I don't know how those guys walk around without being stooped over. But this is a miniature Maester's chain, a more practical, shall we say.
All right, end credits. Let's get out of here.
Okay, we want you to join the conversation. Ask us a question. Suggest a topic for us to discuss in an upcoming episode. Call us. Leave us a voicemail, 312-948-4687. That number is on our Facebook if you haven't written it down. There's also a toll-free number that I'm also going to recite to you. It is 855-923-9993. You can find us online at wbez.org/nerdatrecaps. You can also use GOT Nerdcaps as your little hashtag if you want to. We are at Nerdat Podcast on Twitter. Peter is at Peter Segal.
I am
at Greta M. Johnson. Trisha is at Trisha Bobita.
That's so many Twitter handles.
I know. Well, you know, just in case they want to like hang out with us on Twitter.
Absolutely, they should. And thanks to Chicken and Bird for writing us a really lovely review on Apple Podcasts that helps spread the good word about the show. So thank you for that.
The show is produced by us with excellent help from the most excellent Justin Bull.
Our executive producer is Joel Meyer.
And our theme music was composed by Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music.
Only four more episodes.
Oh, man. Is that true? Wow.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.